Hello and welcome to The Squeal, PIC's swine management podcast featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. Today, we've assembled many years of experience to discuss gilt selection, setting criteria, getting the job done. Joining us from Iowa State University is swine genetic specialist Dr. Ken Stalder, gene transfer supply account manager at PIC Malcolm Turley, and Marlon Tafts, PIC quality assurance manager.
Marlon Tafts with PIC, been with PIC this year for 40 years, basically in a production capacity with PIC, a lot of it doing the selection training, quality assurance work within PIC, originally from California, born and raised in California, was a forestry major, moved back to Wisconsin in 78, more or less on a whim, and started in an entry-level position for PIC, and 40 years later, here I am still.
Malcolm Turley with PIC, been here not quite as long as Marlon, but 30 years, similar background, animal science major. Started off at PIC in the finisher side of things, working and selecting boars and gilts. Moved through the company through inventory management. Managed a couple of sow farms, and work a lot with Marlon on the quality assurance side, as well as with our gene transfer centers.
Dr. Ken Stalder.
My name's Ken Stalder, been with Iowa State now since 2003, started my career at the University of Tennessee, been working in sow longevity and feet and leg area really all of my career, which even spans back to my undergraduate days where I had my early experience in the boar test stations. So it's been an exciting and ever-changing area, and still seems to be an area of interest yet today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I really appreciate you guys coming in, sitting down this morning. We're just immediately prior to the PIC symposium, where there's going to be a lot of good information that's shared on some really high-tech topics. Today, it's kind of a step back into the basics, and yet it's critical that we get this part right, because we're talking about the importance of gilt selection. And one of the first questions that was suggested was, how do we set up our environment in order to best be positioned to view, to select the right animals when we're in that process? Because we've all been in places where I can't see, there's not enough space. How should it be set up?
Way back when the industry started, we used to have specialized areas where there were selection areas that you could actually take your animals to a room or a space where you could evaluate the animals, see them walking around and moving around, and be able to assess the animal's phenotype, underlines, and things like that. But as farms got bigger, it became more difficult to find that particular space without having moved the animals from one end of the building to the other. So it was decided then just to select the animals in the rooms or in the pens themselves. But at the same time, you have to still allow yourself that ability to view the animals. So you have to figure out some way or some space to allow yourself to view the animals. And that could be, if you have an empty pen, splitting the pen in half, just to be able to see the animals walking around and moving around.
I generally agree with that, because I think, as was stated, getting a good view at that animal, and so that you can look clearly at their feet, clear down at the slat level, is a key component. Get a good view at their underline is critical to this evaluation, and if you don't do it correct at that level, just leads to the kind of problems we're seeing today.
You know, as Marlon mentioned before, on those selection areas we had that had nice solid flooring, well, that was really nice to be able to evaluate the animals. But now, as Kim points out, that, you know, we're in a finisher more or less with slats where we've got to select those animals. And when it's so crowded and you can't see the animal, you know, unless you're 10 or 12 feet away, you can't see that underline. So all you're seeing is the back of the animal. Well, there's more to evaluate than just the back of the animal, right? So we got to look at the teats, the underlines, We got to look at the vulva, you know, all those things. So nothing more depressing, I guess, is to go in a finisher and somebody's selecting gilts and you see an empty pin over on the side. And we talk about this, you know, give yourself the best view. And they're wanting to select in the pin. It's like, why don't we just open up the gate, allow them to spread out so we can really see these guys walk.
Criteria. I mean, we've already talked about, well, we want to check, make sure the underlines, the number of teats we need, the look at the vulva condition, things like that. So is there a priority, a list of the top five, we've got to get these right to have the right animals in our breeding program?
Well, I think certainly there's each customer may have their own foundation of criteria, if you will. What's important to them, what they're sensitive to, but certainly, you know, reproductive underlines, structural integrity, how the animal moves, the conformation of the animal, you know, those are the kind of the fundamentals, but what areas you prioritize those in are up to that person selecting. One customer may put more emphasis on one thing than another, maybe underlines are key or maybe leg structure is a certain type of leg structure that they feel successful in their environment, maybe more at top of the priority list as well, too.
I would say that this is a really expensive place to throw somebody into without the proper training. However, having been on farm, when somebody's not there that day, and it's the day to do that, how should we train our people to make sure that they are prepared to go in and really maximize this event?
You know, I think first is as you go in there and make sure we've got agreement amongst all parties on what our standards are so that everybody knows, all right, here's what we're going to use for the basis, right? And have those people that have looked and evaluated gilts before, that understand structure, that understand movement. And, you know, this is not something we want to rush through. It's something we want to take time and evaluate the animals. But I think really key is saying, here's the standards we have, and these are the standards we're going to use, and that's kind of going to be our line in the sand, that we're going to adhere to this to make things better down the road for our future gilts.
How do you do that? Well, as far as, well, foundation, as far as walking, as far, I mean, do you watch videos? Is this a half a day on board?
You know, most of the time when Marlon and I are at farms, I mean, we like to go to their home turf, so to speak. We like to spend at least a day, you know, with someone so that they understand. And we'll pull out individual animals and kind of compare and contrast differences on leg structure and how they walk. And if that takes more than one day, that's fine. We're willing to come back. But it's not just, you know, you look at 10 gilts and suddenly you've seen everything. Probably for me, I use the saying, you know, once you look at 1,000, okay, now you might be ready to start to say, okay, now I'll start to see the structure. Now I'll start to see and understand how pigs move, you know, what's going on there, what impacts they're having as they get bigger on weight.
Almost sounds like you would have an apprenticeship type program where if I'm in there doing that, I need somebody in there with me, not because they couldn't be doing something else, but in the eventuality.
That's true. I mean, typically we like to have a trained person. So if there's kind of an quote intern, so to speak, that he can spend maybe a certain length of time with that person when they do that. Because you always think I have to have a contingency if that main person isn't there, who's going to take over to do it if somebody's not there. So we'll try and, if we can, assign them with a more, trained person, if you will, just to make sure that he can learn the criteria through that person and just see what the day-to-day activities are with them as far as the selection process as well, too.
I like all of those ideas. I think we need to have people that are more experienced, and we need to start valuing those people that do selection maybe with more, I don't know whether it's necessarily compensation or what, but those people have such a critical role in the downstream production and profitability of the operation, and we're seeing that now, I think, because of if you look at the industry, we have quite a lot of culling and mortality due to feet and leg soundness. That's the emphasis on this is coming to light. And so that when we train people, we need to put them with people like Marlon and people like Malcolm and let them spend a significant amount of time. And I start off trying to teach people to identify the extremes in the traits. And if you can find those, typically, most of the time, the extremes are what you don't want. And then those are easier to identify. And then most of the time, if you can get the extremes out of there, you can do a pretty good job of making your gilts better.
That's a good process. Ken, while you're talking, go ahead and spec an animal for me. What are the numbers we should be looking for?
Well, just in general, I like to have the animal be in the top three quarters of a contemporary group for growth, so I'm not selecting any animal that's slow growing. I like to start off by looking at what I call the all or nothing traits, and that by that I mean either their vulva is good enough or it's not, their underlying's either good enough or it's not, and then if it those in either case, if the gilt's not good enough, I don't need to go on and look at anything else. That's kind of done. And then beyond that, then I can look at feet and legs where there's some more give and take, where there's more more judgment in the process that you have to look at. And then finally, look at some of the other body conformation areas like leanness and muscling kind of last, where again, you're looking more for those extremes than you're looking for anything else. So that's a general process that I kind of think about.
Yeah, I would do pretty much the same as Dr. Stalder and, you know, look at the reproductive side first. I look at teats, you know, make sure those look right and the right number of teats. For us, that would be 14 number of normal appearing teats. We wouldn't evaluate those on a gilt until she's, you know, at least what we would term a breeder weaner heavy. So she's 110 days of age or so. Same process, you know, if I see a belly rupture, obviously she's out and I don't need to evaluate further or waste my time on her. But then going from underlines to vulva and anus, and then similarly look at legs and start to evaluate things there.
I don't know if any of you recommend this, but I have producers start looking at underlines even at any time they handle them when they're lighter, because sometimes it's easier to look at them then. And if you find anything that's abnormal, you can go ahead and identify that gilt so you don't have to look at them later on as well.
What are places that we can really mess up? I mean, when we're making selections, what are things, you know, we've talked about kind of the order, and I thought Ken had a great outline of, you know, this is most important, followed by this. If they don't make these two or three things, what's the point of going on? But where can we really screw up if we don't do this in the right way?
Well, I think the first thing is make sure you're allotting the correct amount of time to do the job. I mean, people will ask me, how long does it take to select a pen of gills? And I say, well, I can do it in 5 minutes or I can do it in 20 minutes. You know, what kind of look do you get in 5 minutes? If you've got another job to do and you're thinking about doing that other job, but you think that I've got a half hour here to select these five pens, I can get it done. You're probably more apt to miss something if that's the case. So allot yourself the correct amount of time during the day for that job. It's an important job that needs to have a certain amount of time dedicated to it, so you can really look at those animals and evaluate those animals that, you know, are going to be the foundation and coming back into your herd as well, too. So you want to make sure you allow the time to make those decisions.
Is there a difference in time of day?
I guess I would say, I mean, obviously if it's in the heat or hot of the day, you know, I'd probably like to be what's most comfortable for the animals. Certainly we see people select any time of the day, but certainly try to be cognizant of their temperatures and make sure we're doing the right things for them.
And not only for the animals, but for the people as well, too. There's probably a certain amount of fatigue that you may get during the course of the day. So if I had my druthers maybe in the morning, the animals are fresh, you're feeling fresh, so to speak, and maybe you don't have any other jobs ahead of you right then at that moment. So, you know, you've got a good, clear mind at that time of day, and just start out the day by doing it when it's cool in the morning and when you don't have any other jobs lined up so far.
You know, sometimes we think about breeder fatigue when we're AI-ing sows or gilts, but I think there is a selection fatigue. And when they all start looking the same, you know, or you're not able to pick out, you know, the things you need to pick out, then take a break, come back, take a 15-minute timeout, and let's come back a little bit more, you know, refreshed and refocused on what we need to be looking at.
I would agree with that, and I'd even suggest maybe there's probably a limit on the number we need to look at in a day, because I'm guessing your criteria at the beginning and what your criteria at the end might be may become a little more lax if you're trying to do this for an 8-hour stretch and all you're doing is trying to select animals. And we really need to try to be more consistent across all the time, and it's fatigue that contributes to our mental fatigue that'll contribute to that. Maybe you become a little more lax in your criteria later, the longer you do it.
So how do we evaluate how we're doing? Are there production criteria, pigs per sow per year? How do we evaluate whether or not we've got the right guy doing this, the right lady doing this, the right selection process?
I guess for me, I think about, we need to get those sows to that third and fourth parity, to those parities that really, they're really reproductive, they hit the reproductive stride, if you will, and the more pigs per sow per year. But we got to get them there first. So in order to get them there, you know, they can't leave or exit because of lameness or something that maybe we had an impact on during gilt selection, that, you know, we brought in a marginal gilt that we know we shouldn't have to hit, quote, a number. You know, that's not what this is about. It's about quality. It's about defining our standards. And so I think retention rate in the sow herd, you know, how many, what percent exits a sow herd on lameness, say from parity 1 to 2, you know, we need to monitor that and be able to measure that so we know, because I think that's a direct impact on back on how we did our gilt selection.
I'd also interject here, you mentioned pigs per sow per year, and I've fought this battle for a while. I think it's kind of a nebulous term. It can be manipulated a lot of ways by managers who know what they're doing. And I think the critical criteria from the gilt selection standpoint is pigs produced per lifetime. And if we can start get producers to think about their breeding herd and how, in terms of, you know, how many pigs did my sow produce per lifetime, that's really the trait that has more economic value. If you think of this sow as a little factory, she has to produce so many piglets to be profitable. And it's not a pigs per sow per year per se. It's a, you know, how many pigs did she produce in her lifetime? And those that like to argue that, you know, well, that doesn't take into account that she's going to have a bunch of non-productive days. Well, we can take that term and say pigs produced per day of herd life, if you'd like, but we just need to get producers looking at a much different value than when what we are now. And I think that's something I've tried to talk for several years now, that maybe we need to get away from PSY and start looking at that value. And not had a lot of takers yet, but I think there's people really looking at that value now as well.
Changing direction a bit, sow housing. Sow housing, gilt selection. You know, obviously we've had conversations in the past about temperament, but when we're actually selecting those animals, do we select them knowing what type of housing they're headed to?
Yeah, I think the criteria has to remain is equal really for both. I mean, both have their own rigors they have to stand up to. So, I mean, the criteria basically between the two still has to be the same critical criteria you would use in standard housing or other. Keeping in mind two of them are both different types of housing, but the criteria still mean the foundation, the fundamentals still need to be the same.
I would agree with Marlon, because no matter what you're doing, you still have to have the underlying, you still have to have the good vulva, and the foundation of your feet and legs, the general criteria of that still have to be the same. So, yeah, I would agree with those comments.
age of guilt at selection. We talked briefly about 110 days when we're evaluating that. Is that just the rule of thumb?
I think when we're looking at underline, certainly we'd say that that's when that underline for those guilts becomes what we would term mature, or we could evaluate that guilt then. Most producers probably are selecting guilts, you know, somewhere around that 20 to 23 weeks of age, I would guess, on evaluating those criteria for those replacement guilts coming back in their herd today.
So you mentioned a little earlier trying to reach a number as far as the number of guilts that you've selected. Is that the biggest issue in making sure that we're selecting the right animals today?
Well, if you're talking about the right number and how you get there, I guess there's two things that I look at. Depending on the size of the herd and your ability to select the right amount of numbers is critical, because if you don't have enough big enough herd to produce those animals, you end up dipping below the standard. So then it becomes more of a utilization rate than a selection rate, because your pool of animals isn't big enough to pick from. So to get the animals and the numbers that you want, you may dip below the standard. So you're utilizing animals you might not normally want to use, but you're being forced to, so you can provide your animals for your breeders to hit mating targets as well, too. So you always want to have a big enough pool of animals to pick from, so you have good animals going into your herd, and you don't have to have animals that you think that, well, I think she might be able to hold up for a litter or two. And then pretty soon, those are the ones that are going down early in the early parities as well, too. So just making sure you have a big enough pool of animals to pick from that you can make good decisions with.
I agree with that. But what I generally see most operations, though, are sized when everything kind of runs perfectly. And if you have a operation with any number of sows at all, that rarely happens. And unfortunately, your multiplication size is too small, and that forces producers to keep less desirable gilts. Unfortunately, even to the case, if it's the gilt's got a vulva and can walk, there's too many herds that have to keep, and that's their selection criteria, and that's not selection criteria, and that gets us into the kind of trouble we're seeing today, in my opinion.
100% agree, Dr. Stalder. I mean, we see it time and time again where they don't size that thing right, and everything looks good in those winter months or you know, before the heat, and then come August when things stop cycling, suddenly we've got to make these choices that aren't good for us long term, but we go ahead and bring her in, as you say, because she's got a vulva and four legs, and so suddenly we can make mating target because we need her.
Yep.
And that's not a good plan long term.
And it cannot necessarily be just in the summer months. If you have a sow herd or two go down with a disease, for example, PRRS, and you got to repopulate that, and all of a sudden your system's not big enough to handle that, we're going into that downward spiral where we end up keeping everything. And we just got to think through that process better and have that contingency to where, hey, if something breaks, we can handle that and have the multiplication, the size, sized enough that can handle it.
Is there a industry, I don't know what I'd call it a standard, but an average? What do you breed overage just to make sure you have plenty for your stalls? 10%? Does it vary from location to location?
I'm sure those guys have answers, but I think it varies by location and season and producer.
Actually, they kind of look like deer in the headlights here when I ask that, so I don't know that that's, you know, that's exactly right. But
yeah, I would agree. You know, if you're in the heat of the South, you're gonna change things a little bit come summertime to take care of those those breed backs or the retention. The repeat sows, if you will. So yeah, it could be 10 to 15% at least. Yeah.
Well, just knowing what your throwing rate is doing as well, too, what your performance is, can be an indicator, too. Could you be breeding more or less, or in that case there. So it's taking all those things into consideration to give you that number that you'll need.
Yeah. And that can be affected by health as well. And that's part of the reason why you're not getting a steadfast answer from any of us.
Questions for each other.
Dr. Stalder, I've got one for you. You know, we get a lot of pushback on gilts, especially on the front legs, where they're, we get a lot of people that look down at that pastern, where they're more soft or more sloped to their pastern. And to me, those are gilts that always, do survive on the concrete we've asked them to survive on. How do we get people to be more favorable or more receptive to those gilts? It seems like everybody's a little bit worried about those dew claws and are they going to catch the slats? And I understand on the back legs, you know, where they're weak pastern, but on the front legs, those are the gilts that have more slope to their shoulder. And yet I think we still get a little pushback on some of those gilts being too soft up front.
Well, the thing I tell you is that every study we've done, and we've looked at a lot of numbers, those type of sows are tough and last in the herd longer than anybody else. And when I get a chance to talk to producers, I don't call them weak front pasterns, I call them soft. And so I think part of it's changing the terminology and the mindset, and then keep telling them that for every one of those that they catch a dew claw on the slats, you'll have 10 more of them that stay in the herd much longer than the average sow. So you want to keep them all day long. And I just publicly state, you know, if you don't want them, I'll take every one of them, and I'll outproduce you all day long.
Other questions?
I don't know if it's so much a question, but just an observation and looking at the history, and we've all been doing this long enough now, just how the females have evolved over time, where they may have been a little longer, maybe a little leaner, and now you look at the animals over the years putting on the mass they're putting on, not only growing quickly, but putting on the mass in their bodies, but in particular their hindquarters, where again, structure becomes so important to be able to not only carry that mass of muscle, and this is on our maternal lines too, but also the weight of the expected litters. You're expecting litters of 14 to 16, you know, total born and born alive. So to be able to manage that weight and that mass just puts more emphasis on structure again, in particular, back leg structure as well too, and the expectation of having these animals last for as many parities as they can last for.
I totally agree with you, and I think we're asking that sow to do more and more. And I think we've changed the sow somewhat by our selecting for lean muscle tissue growth, and we've changed some of the secondary sexual characteristics. For example, our signs of puberty, vulva size probably has changed a little bit as we've selected for that. So selecting for lean muscle mass, we had to do it to meet consumer demand, don't get me wrong, but it hasn't come without some consequences as well. I was reading an old book. I'm kind of a history buff, and I picked up an old book from England, and just to give you a perspective on longevity, it had pictures of old sows in there, and I thought, well, they wouldn't put pictures in there animals they thought were, you know, not their most desirable, so that had to be what they thought were at least ideal for the time. And then I got to reading in there, and I know this is just an instance of one case, but you have to take into account how they talked back then in very proper English. But to make a long story short, they talked about a particular sow that produced into her 17th year, and she averaged between 8 and 10 pigs per litter, and she produced 2 litters per year, and this was in 1755. And you think about the kind of facilities they had back then, the nutrition they had back then, that's pretty darn good longevity for a sow back then. And you start to think about, okay, what have we done to change that sow that had that genetic potential even as much as 200, 250 years ago, that we've changed them, that we're having the kind of difficulty that we are today? I think that's just really interesting.
What do you see as the biological breaking point in asking how many pigs can these sows really produce? Where is that? Or do we know that? And should we be concerned about that, you know, as far as just the biology of the animal and the expectation of the animal?
Are you asking per litter, Marlon? Or are you asking per lifetime? What basis are you
asking? I would say for lifetime.
Yeah. We've all seen certain animals that have the capability to produce for many litters and have well over 100 pigs in their lifetime. And I think that ought to be achievable biology, you know, from a biological basis. I think it's our management and how we care and start to focus on the individual animal rather than the entire. We generally, when we go into a farrowing house, we think about the group of sows because, and we don't tend to focus on the individual as much. But on an individual basis there's certainly genetic potential from a biological basis to go much further than what we have today. And I think it's our management ability to extract that from those individual sows that's lacking. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying that maybe we need to change our way of thinking on a management perspective. And how do we do that? I'm not quite sure because of the sow herd size and that sort of thing. It's hard to look at, you know, try to treat individuals. But I think as we start to look at it, the individual sows, maybe we can help reduce the incidence of lameness and those kind of things when we start looking at the individuals rather than the population. And that takes really good stock people to do that.
That would, I guess, lead me to a next question as well, too. Where do we see the industry going as far as being able to attract those good stock people, or where are they going to come from? Do we have enough people in the schools that are interested in that? What do we see as far as being able to track that for the number of farms and sows we have out there?
I think attraction of talent to our industry is maybe our biggest challenge facing us in the future. And how do we attract those really skilled people that have the kind of stockmanship skills that we need to achieve the kind of production we're talking about today is really going to be a paramount task in the next 5 to 10 years. What do you guys see as the single biggest maybe fault or reason where we could do a better job on the selection end today that sows are leaving the breeding herd of most farms?
I think the first thing, which starts early on, I think, and inhibits the growth and development of the animal, is number one, stocking densities. Myself, is that people aren't paying enough attention to stocking densities early on. So I think the animal can be challenged as far as growth, feeder space, feed intake, and in some cases where they're treating their breeding stock that they want to select back in to their own herd more like a commercial animal, and maybe not allowing them an extra allowance of space and consideration so those animals can flourish in a good environment and grow and develop and then have a good selection rate at the end because they've been allowed for those things to happen as well.
I 100% agree, and what disappoints me the most is to go in a finisher and, you know, you see the replacement gilts in the same pen as their barrels. And that's their next generation. And you know, why are those barrels taking up valuable space, feeder space, all those things to help those gilts get everything they need to go on the next, into the herd? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
They don't realize what effect that's going to have on that gilt for her productive lifetime, I don't think.
They lose out genetically, and then obviously that equals economically.
Yep.
So I think that, along with, you know, having the, as we talked about before, the sizing of your gilt pool to make sure that's sized correctly. and then make sure your GDU, you know, you've got a big enough space in there that you can house all those animals, that it doesn't become, you know, a numbers game on just a utilization rate.
So what percentage of farms do you guys think are treating their gilts in that manner? Any estimate?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go 50%, if that's being, just to give you a ballpark for your just observations, but, you know, we're certainly putting more emphasis on that, you know, allow your animals that are coming back and herd more room. But at the same time, we look at facilities. How old are these facilities, which were built to accommodate a flow of maybe 24 to 25 pigs, but now they're doing 27, 28, maybe up to 30. So it's, you know, the same buildings, but having to accommodate more pigs and manage those flows, which puts more stress on the pen size and how you stock those pens.
Along with the more mass and size we've added to these gilts, right?
Yeah,
so that
exactly.
Everybody takes up more space.
If you're building new, you can hopefully build enough space, but I've been hard pressed to find people that will usually build for more space. They want to build
right.
just enough so that they can get there and a little extra overage. But a little extra overage sometimes adds to a lot of overage. And that's where we run into problems.
But can you imagine if it is somewhat even close to half, what that impacts on the production records that we see our industry average every year? It's a massive impact.
Joining us on The Squeal today were Dr. Ken Stalder, professor at Iowa State University, and PIC's Marlon Tafts and Malcolm Turley with tips on improving gilt selection in your operation. You're welcome to share this PIC podcast widely in your organization. In fact, we encourage it. For PIC, the international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.